Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the April 9th, 2021 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows a graveyard scene. All the headstones are in rows and all look shaped the same. The one in the foreground says George Floyd and has kind of a black power fist up at the top. There are flowers in front of the grave, and kneeling on those flowers is police officer Derek Chauvin, very much in the same pose that he was in the video where he was arresting Floyd and ended up in Floyd's death. The headline is Justice on Trial. Former officer Derek Chauvin's attempt to deny responsibility for George Floyd's death. That is indeed our first main story, and we'll start right there. Accused murderer of George Floyd goes on trial. What happened? Jurors heard competing accounts this week of why George Floyd died at the hands of Minneapolis police as the trial began of Derek Chauvin, the former officer who stands accused of murdering Floyd in a racially charged death that triggered massive demonstrations and a national reckoning over systemic racism. Prosecutors replayed the infamous cell phone video that showed Chauvin impassively kneeling on Floyd's neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. As the black 46-year-old arrested for allegedly using a counterfeit $20 bill to buy cigarettes pleaded, "I can't breathe," and distraught onlookers begged Chauvin to stop. The cause of death was clear, prosecutor Jerry Blackwell told jurors. Chauvin choked the life out of him. "You can believe your eyes," he said. "It's homicide. It's a murder." Chauvin's defense attorney, Eric Nelson, told jurors not to rely on the video, saying it fails to reveal a more complicated reality. He said Floyd, who had fentanyl and methamphetamines in his system, died from a mix of intoxication, heart disease, and hypertension, aggravated by adrenaline from the struggle. "The evidence is far greater than 9 minutes and 29 seconds," said Nelson. Prosecutors called several witnesses to the stand, including Darnella Frazier, who filmed the viral video. Frazier, 18, wept as she recalled Floyd begging for his life and the cold look on Chauvin's face. She spoke of wrestling with guilt for not doing more to save Floyd, who, she said, could have been her father or brother. "We all knew it wasn't right," she said. A city firefighter tearfully recounted offering medical assistance to Floyd and being rebuffed by one of Chauvin's three partners. "I was desperate to help," she said. "There was a man being killed." Security was tight for one of the most closely watched trials in decades, with the Minneapolis courthouse ringed by metal fencing, concrete barriers, and National Guard troops. Ben Crump, a lawyer for Floyd's family, cast the trial as a test of whether police who wrongfully kill black men in America can be held accountable. "The whole world is watching," Crump said. What the editorial said: after the speeches, the hashtags, the marches, this trial will judge one man's guilt or innocence, said the New York Daily News. The facts seem clear. Despite Floyd's drug intake and his health issues, the autopsies leave no doubt that Chauvin's depraved actions asphyxiated George Floyd. We pray he pays a steep price. "The trial is another test of just how much black lives matter in this country," said the Baltimore Sun. "Time and again, police officers who've killed African Americans have walked away despite damning evidence. Think of Breonna Taylor, Tamir Rice, Michael Brown, Eric Garner. All died at the hands of police. No one was held accountable in court. We can only hope this time the jury will send a loud and clear message that police who use excessive force will face the consequences. What the columnist said. What's on trial here is a belief system that started long before Floyd was murdered, said L.Z. Granderson in the Los Angeles Times. For centuries, black America has watched police and our justice system use every tool imaginable to try to prove that our lives do not matter. Compare how Floyd was treated over a $20 bill to how police treated the white insurrectionists who stormed the Capitol on January 6. That's why even with Chauvin's brutality caught on video, many of us are worried that won't be enough. Those who expect a murder conviction should be forewarned, said retired FBI agent James Gagliano in the New York Post. Chauvin's actions were repugnant and, yes, criminal. But Floyd's drug use and heart condition, which the county medical examiner said may have contributed to his death, complicate matters, and proving that Chauvin intended to kill Floyd may be impossible. He's more likely to be convicted of manslaughter, recklessly endangering Floyd's life. Let's remember that Chauvin is the man on trial, not Floyd, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. His casual kneeling on Floyd's neck looks like a performance, a demonstration of the police's domination over the African-American neighborhood they were assigned to protect. That is the essence of the problem with police violence in this country. The video is damning, said former prosecutor Ellie Honig in CNN.com. But anybody who tells you they know for sure what any jury will do has never tried a case. Juries are made up of human beings, and we humans are nothing if not mercurial. The uncertainty doubles in any case involving the police, multiplied again when the case involves race. Now we'll see if the jury can find its way through this thicket to justice. The stakes for the entire country are enormous. Our controversy of the week is titled Voting Rights. Is Georgia's new law Jim Crow 2.0? This was the week the Republican effort to suppress the vote at all costs became reality, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. Georgia Governor Brian Kemp, flanked by six white fellow Republicans and standing under a painting of a former slave plantation, signed Georgia's SB 202, a 96-page package of laws designed to make it harder for Georgians, African Americans in particular, to vote. Among other shameful measures, the bill restricts the use of mail-in ballots and ballot drop boxes, which black Georgians used disproportionately in 2020, while requiring absentee voters to provide copies of state-issued ID that 200,000 voters, disproportionately black, don't possess. After the terrible election cycle in 2020, explained Republican election official Alice Olenek, laws needed to be changed, so we at least have a shot at winning. The law even criminalizes giving food or water to voters waiting in line, said Zach Bocamp in Vox.com. Why? Hint. The hours-long voting lines in Georgia's majority black urban centers are among the worst in the country. The new law even authorizes the state legislature, controlled by Republicans, to overrule county boards of election, disqualifying voters and ballots as they see fit. President Biden was not exaggerating this week when he slammed the law as Jim Crow in the 21st century. To borrow Biden's favorite phrase, "Come on, man," said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. SB 202 actually preserves absentee balloting, but with an earlier application deadline and a voter ID number replacing unreliable signature matching to verify each ballot. Dropbox is instituted because of the pandemic will be more tightly regulated, but will continue. How is it Jim Crow 2.0 to give absentee voters more options than they had in 2019? As for the infamous water ban, said Dan McLaughlin in NationalReview.com, the law allows elections officials to provide food and water to waiting voters. What's now banned are activists in union T-shirts or MAGA hats handing out Poland Spring or pizza as a form of subtle or overt electioneering. The bill would have been much worse had an outcry not forced Republicans to water it down, said Ed Kilgore in NYMag.com. The proposed ban on Sunday souls to the polls voting, for example, was dropped. But we have a rich record of public comments affirming the law's nefarious partisan intentions. Governor Kemp justified the new law by citing alarming issues with how the 2020 election was handled. Even though hand recounts, audits, and Republican elections officials found no evidence of fraud. The only alarming issue was that Democrats won, said Steve Bannon in MSNBC.com, and the law's most ominous provision has a cure for that. Partisan state legislators now have the power to intervene to reject ballots and make other critical elections decisions, making it possible for Georgia Republicans to legally do what Donald Trump demanded, simply refuse to certify a legitimately elected Democratic ticket. Republicans don't care if this all looks racist, said Paul Waldman in the Washington Post. In fact, they want Democrats to accuse them of racism. Why? Because it fires up their own voters, who are told hourly by Fox News and talk radio that accusations of racism are a weapon in the liberal plot to silence conservatives and subjugate white people. This paranoid narrative not only drives Republican voters to the polls, it distracts them from asking what the GOP has actually done for them lately. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for resilience. After Long Beach, California, Mayor Robert Garcia vowed that the city's rainbow-striped Pride lifeguard tower, which was burned down last week in an apparent hate crime, will be rebuilt even gayer. It was a good week for taking a really deep breath after Croatian daredevil Budimir Buda Sobot, 54, broke his own world record by staying underwater without breathing for an inconceivable 24 minutes and 33 seconds. It was a good week for naviphobes and megalophobes, as those with a fear of ships and large objects are respectively known, who found relief when the grounded Ever Given was freed in the Suez Canal. Hearing about the ship's predicament caused goosebumps all over my body, Grace Gibson, 26, of Los Angeles, told TheGuardian.com. But it was a bad week for the brothers Cuomo, with reports that in the early days of the pandemic, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo sent state medical officials to the homes of VIPs, including his younger brother, CNN anchor Chris Cuomo, to administer scarce coronavirus tests. It was a bad week for Brexiting after 500 British expats were ordered to leave Spain before the end of March, under the terms of Britain's separation from the EU, or risk arrest and deportation. Yes, I voted out, said Sean Cromer, but I didn't realize it would come to this. Finally, it was a bad week for Mark Farron Claude Biart, 53, a fugitive mafia boss who was arrested after 7 years of hiding in the Dominican Republic. He blew his cover by hosting an Italian cooking show on YouTube. Biart hid his face from the camera, but Italian police said he failed to disguise his telltale arm tattoos and his love for Italian cuisine. Short news piece before we move on. Biden lays out infrastructure plan. President Biden unveiled a $2 trillion economic plan this week, a politically contentious effort to beef up domestic manufacturing, rebuild American infrastructure, and cut use of fossil fuels. The sprawling patchwork of proposals would replace every lead pipe in the nation, repair 10,000 bridges, create a national network of 500,000 electric vehicle charging stations, and ensure broadband coverage for every citizen by 2030. The proposals include an increase of the corporate tax rate from 21 to 28% and a plan to force multinational companies to pay more tax on overseas profits. The administration aims to pair the ambitious 8-year plan with a package of health care and child care initiatives to be released later this month. We're on the briefing page. The topic this week, grading charter schools. Independent alternatives to public schools have sprung up across the nation. Are they succeeding? What are charter schools? They're publicly funded, independently run alternatives to traditional public schools. They have greater freedom than standard public schools to develop their own curricula and budgets, hire and fire teachers over performance, and set schedules and behavior rules such as mandating uniforms. The charter in the name refers to a contract between the school and the state oversight body, or authorizer. Since the first charter school opened in Minnesota in 1992, their numbers have boomed to more than 7,500 charter schools across 43 states and the District of Columbia. More than 3.3 million students now attend one, a number that's tripled since 2006. In some cities, including Detroit and New Orleans, a majority of public school students attend charter schools. The charter school movement remains highly controversial, but most experts agree that the best charters are producing phenomenal results. There's a group at the top that are just remarkably successful in terms of helping students move forward. Margaret Raymond, the director of Stanford University's Center for Research on Education Outcomes, Credo, told New York Magazine, they're using resources in a dramatically different way. Why are they controversial? Teachers' unions and some progressives say that charter schools siphon off public education dollars with lax oversight and very mixed results. Charter school advocates say they offer much-needed choice to parents and kids in poor neighborhoods with failing public schools, where many African-American and Hispanic students often lag white counterparts in wealthier districts by 3 or 4 grade levels. Charter schools also introduce free market competition into education. They have to attract students who only attend them by choice, and if the schools underperform, they can be shut down by states. Less hidebound by rules and tradition, charter schools are free to be incubators of innovation, as charter school booster President Obama put it in 2012. Charter schools with the best track records, such as Success Academy, the Knowledge is Power program, and Uncommon Schools, have longer school days, provide intensive tutoring, enforce order and discipline in classrooms, and promote high expectations for students, including that they will go on to college. There is no tenure protection for teachers, and if their students do not make the expected progress, they are fired. How have charters performed? There's no simple answer. The charter track record can best be described as stunningly uneven, wrote the authors of the 2016 book, Charter Schools at the Crossroads. For-profit charters, which make up about 13% of the total, have had mostly disappointing results. In general, state and federal studies have found that charters produce higher student achievement than regular public schools in poor, non-white urban areas, but in rural and suburban areas are not significantly better than public schools, and are sometimes worse. The Brookings Institution concluded in 2019 that, on average, charter schools and traditional schools' performance is about the same. But charter advocates say that the numbers have steadily improved as less effective schools are weeded out. In some big cities, the advocates say the charter's success is spectacular. What's the proof? In Boston, a team of researchers concluded that charter schools had reduced the black-white reading gap in middle school by two-thirds. A 2015 Credo study found urban charters gave their students the equivalent of 40 additional school days of learning in math and 28 additional days of learning in reading every year. After Hurricane Katrina, New Orleans made every public school a charter school. Since then, the graduation rate has grown by 9%. The number of students attending college has jumped 10%. And student math and reading scores have moved from the 22nd percentile nationally to the 37th. It is very unusual to see programs and policies improve all of these outcomes, said researchers Douglas Harris and Matthew Larson of Tulane University. What is the future of charter schools? Politically, the ground has shifted in recent years. While support among conservatives remains strong, progressive opposition has intensified out of fears that charters will undermine public education. The opposition hardened during the presidency of Donald Trump, whose education secretary, Betsy DeVos, was a staunch charter school advocate. In 2016, the NAACP called for a moratorium on the expansion of charters. In Los Angeles County, the Board of Education has called for a moratorium on new charters. In New York City, where 235 charter schools serve 123,000 students, Mayor Bill de Blasio has said he hates charters and is trying to restrict their growth. On the campaign stump, President Joe Biden declared himself not a charter school fan, and in a 2018 poll, only 36% of Democrats supported charter schools. Sociologist Eve Ewing, who studies education, says the analysis of charter school performance has become more of an ideological debate, split neatly into opposing factions, than it is a polity discussion informed by facts. And we'll read a few of the best columns of the week. We'll start with two from the U.S. First, when debt will no longer be cheap. The Biden administration is flooding the markets with newly issued U.S. debt, said Kevin Williamson. Democrats intend to keep the tap wide open as long as they can, borrowing and spending trillions on the assumption that interest rates will remain far below their historical average. When you can borrow for next to nothing, why not max out? But interest on our exploding national debt already consumes 11% of federal taxes. When interest rates inevitably rise, the cost of the federal government's debt service could soar to half of all tax revenue or even higher. The U.S. would have to spend about as much on interest payments as it does on national defense or Social Security. We'd either need to make massive cuts in spending, swallow even higher interest payments, or go into default. Defaulting would crater the U.S. economy and set off an economic crisis unlike anything the world has ever seen. The U.S. can either start taking the necessary measures to put our fiscal affairs in order and reduce the deficit and debt to a manageable size, or speed the day when our free lunch is no longer free. The deadly price of Birx's silence. Working for Donald Trump was Dr. Deborah Birx's first and worst mistake, said Megan Ranney. Birx, widely respected for her work on international HIV/AIDS programs, was brought in as coordinator of the White House Coronavirus Task Force last February. She quickly found out that her negligent, disastrously ignorant boss was determined to distort, ignore, and deny science and the truth during the pandemic in order to downplay the coronavirus threat. In an interview for a CNN special this week, Burks put the moral responsibility for the vast majority of COVID deaths, at least 300,000, squarely on Trump, whose scorn of masks and other precautions turned them into partisan symbols. Only the first 100,000 were essentially unavoidable, she said, because infections were already spreading rapidly in New York and California in late February. Focused on the economy and his reelection, Trump encouraged Republican-run states such as Texas and Florida to liberate themselves, accelerating the virus spread. Burks largely let the administration's lies go unchecked. When she did finally warn rural states against that opening up would lead to a horrific surge, Trump berated and intimidated her. Rather than quit and tell the public the truth, she soldiered on. As AIDS activists once said, silence equals death. This column comes from Finland. Happiness is contentment, not ecstasy. Finland has once again been named the happiest country in the world, said Krit Karvala. Although Finns might find that hard to believe this year, what with the coronavirus crisis. The World Happiness Report uses data from the Gallup polls in which people across the planet are asked to evaluate their life on a 0 to 10 scale, with 10 meaning they're living their best possible life. This is the fourth year in a row in which Finland came in first, and as usual, fellow Nordic social democracies Denmark, Norway, and Sweden were also in the top 10. This isn't to say that we Finns walk the earth in a constant state of euphoria. Far from it. In fact, studies show that Finns don't experience great moments of joy and sorrow every day to the same extent as residents of Latin American countries. Instead, our national character is to be even-keeled and content with what we have despite an occasional melancholy. A high level of equality helps prevent feelings of envy. Nordic nations never went through the feudal system that produced inequality in the rest of Europe. Our peasants remained independent. Finns balance individual responsibility with our responsibility to the community. That makes for a happy land. Time for the last word, our in-depth article. The headline this week is The Children's Crossing. More children and families are making the dangerous trip in rafts across the Rio Grande, hoping they will be allowed to stay in the U.S. and seek asylum, said Arilis R. Hernandez in the Washington Post. Mission, Texas. The question startled Hidalgo County Deputy Constable Roque Vila as he took a quick census of the group of roughly 30 migrants he encountered recently on a dusty road along the Rio Grande in South Texas. "Do you think they are going to be able to help us?" a Honduran mother asked in Spanish, clutching her emerald-eyed toddler and a backpack full of papers she hopes explain her need for asylum in the United States. "That's not a question I can answer," responded the veteran deputy, who rarely says more than a few words to the hundreds of families, teenagers, and children he finds each week in Rincon del Diablo, or Devil's Corner, a heavily wooded span of federal land along the river that's full of thorny brush and a maze of footpaths so confusing that migrants routinely get lost. He escorts those he finds to the base underneath the Anzaldúas International Bridge for processing by U.S. Border Patrol agents, who will answer the woman's uncertainty in one way or another. Last year, as the coronavirus pandemic began, the Trump administration used a temporary public health order to turn away nearly all migrants who arrived seeking asylum. In recent months, following pressure from court challenges and a change in administrations, many more children and families who have made the dangerous journey to the border have been allowed to stay. though the criteria can be cruelly unclear to many migrants. The Biden administration has kept President Donald Trump's order in place, and most adults are still sent away without the chance to plead for asylum. Central American teenagers and children traveling without their parents are now allowed to stay, which has led some parents to send their children across the border alone. The fate of migrant families is less clear. The administration has emphasized that it continues to expel families, but the latest government data shows that the vast majority are now allowed to stay. As migrants gather stories of who has made it across and who has been turned away, the reasoning can seem random. Against so much uncertainty, why do they come? Many of the migrants Vela finds in Rincon del Diablo say they are motivated by a complicated and varied set of personal and practical reasons that intersect where survival meets opportunity. The journey to the border can be life-threatening. Authorities say a 9-year-old migrant girl drowned while trying to cross the Rio Grande earlier this month. But so, too, is staying where they are. A smuggler is both exploiter and allied facilitator. Many migrants are both potent in their determination. One Guatemalan mother said she had been expelled 5 times in the past year with her 10-year-old daughter, but powerless against a U.S. immigration system that was not designed to efficiently handle or respond to their particular needs. And despite all they've heard about family separations during the Trump administration and pleas from the Biden administration not to come, 3 dozen migrants recently interviewed at the border say the decision to migrate is influenced but does not hinge on a particular president or message. Violence, hunger, climate change, persecution, the economic fallout of the pandemic, and reuniting with family are more powerful motivators. They still believe the United States is where they will be safe and can prosper if given the chance. And for many, they see no other option. There is no justice for women in my country, said a 17-year-old Guatemalan girl who said she fled after being sexually abused by criminal gangs. Her family paid smugglers $3,000 to cross the border with a large group of teenagers traveling without parents. I cannot go back. I do not want to go back to my country. Vela's duties have evolved in the past decade from tracking single Mexican and Central American men seeking economic opportunity, along with cartel members running drugs, to waiting by the riverside for rafts packed with migrant families to land and watching the ponytails of little girls bounce with each step of their long walk toward Border Patrol stations. Each successive administration's efforts to manage the flow leaves border officials like Vela in the same place. Vela steers clear of politics. It's not his job. But he can't escape the emotion that comes each time there's a sudden influx in migrants. First in 2014, then in 2019, and now this spring. He still remembers the shock he felt in 2014 when he found a child who had no arms traveling by herself. Night after night in 2019, shadows emerged from the tall grass and grew into long silhouettes as migrants walked toward the headlights of his truck, begging for water. The latest generation of migrants tell Vela they want the same thing his Mexican grandparents found when they settled in the Rio Grande Valley of Texas decades ago. Here we go again, Vela said as he spotted a group of spooked mothers with small children ducking into the brush during a patrol last week. He grabbed his loudspeaker attached to his truck. No corres. Estamos aquí para ayudar. Don't run. We are here to help. The mothers burst into tears of relief mixed with uncertainty. Weeks earlier, they tried to cross the border south of Tucson and were turned away. They had heard from other migrants and smugglers that their chances were better about 1,000 miles east in Reynosa, Mexico, across the river from Mission, Texas. They took buses and walked and found themselves here before the constable in Rincon del Diablo. Evelyn Mendoza, 37, was traveling with her 3 children to their father, who has begun an asylum process in the United States, she said. As she told her story, Mendoza's 3-year-old son tried to console her, kissing her eyes to stop the tears from falling. The Salvadoran mother paid $4,000 to smugglers to cross her family of four and doesn't have money to do it again. Guatemalan migrant Briseida Lucero, 21, who was traveling with her 5-year-old, unfolded a piece of glossy paper from her breast for Vela, revealing the ghastly image of a man she said was her husband, lifelessly prone on the ground with blood splattered around his head. She had been hiding from gangs with her mother, moving from place to place until the older woman died earlier this year. "It's been a month of suffering," said Yasmin Paredes, 21, who traveled with her 4-year-old son and is seeking asylum. She began planning her trip after her husband was killed 2 years ago in southeastern Guatemala. She hesitated to leave her mother, but the increasing threats pushed her to trek northward, hitching rides with anyone who would help her. The only things Paredes had held on to were her identification papers, her husband's death certificate, and hope she will be the exception. "You hear that the United States isn't giving asylum, but I am trusting in God and His will to be done." Over 2 evenings of patrol last week, Vela and fellow deputies encountered more than 400 migrants in a relatively small geographic area between the border cities of Mission and Hidalgo, Texas. The rocky roads that wind along the river's edge are littered with items of clothing, plastic drink bottles, and remnants of a child's pink book bag full of unused diapers. Over the past 3 months, a handful of migrants quickly swelled to scores, including dozens of children in the past few days. Most were teenagers, but Vela took special note of the younger ones, including an 8-year-old Guatemalan girl whose father in Philadelphia sent for her, and 2 Honduran boys, ages 9 and 10. The 8-year-old girl, dressed in a red hooded coat, was traveling with Antolino Martinez and his 11-year-old son, who fled the violence of Honduras and were trying to enter the United States for a second time. "We found her 2 days ago walking by herself in Mexico," said Martinez, 42, who carried the girl's satchel until they reached the Border Patrol station. Criminal gangs forced Martinez's sixth grader to stop attending school in Honduras, and he said he had struggled to work or operate a business with the same organizations demanding payments from him. But he won't dare send his son alone, not yet. "The father's plea to anyone who will listen, give us a hand, please. We just need an opportunity. Things are too complicated in my country. All I want is to work, to move my family forward." Several of the migrant families interviewed said they had heard before reaching the border that parents with small children were being released more frequently into the United States than those with kids older than 7. Some of those families have been sending their older children alone because they have been barred from entering as a family. One 15-year-old Honduran girl said she never intended to cross the border alone. As she and her mother arrived penniless near the international bridge in Mexico last week, she said they were attacked by men they believe were cartel members. The girl's mother distracted their assailants and ordered her girl to run. She sprinted toward the river and boarded a raft to the other side. The teen said she spent a day wandering in the woods, sleeping on the ground and praying for help. On Wednesday, she joined a group of travelers that had come upon the constable's vehicle. "She told me not to look back," the teenager said through sobs, recalling her last moments with her mother. "I thought she was behind me, but when I did look back, she was gone. I don't know what happened to her." The girl, who turned 15 during her month-long trip north from Honduras, left after flooding from 2 hurricanes caused the back wall of her house in Colón to collapse. She, her mother, and younger brothers had been living with relatives, but the arrangement was unsustainable because of a lack of work and money for food. In her front shirt pocket, the teenager carried the address of relatives in the United States, hoping for a reunion with them and a chance to take care of her siblings financially. It is hard for the deputies to understand what compels a parent to allow a child to migrate solo. "I just don't get it," Vela said to his co-worker, Deputy Constable Ray Reyna. I feel bad for them, but we can't have everyone come. My son's 9, and I won't let him outside in the front yard by himself, Reyna added. The stories they hear from the children they meet no longer surprise the deputies. I just followed the people, the 9-year-old Honduran boy said, explaining how he knew which direction to walk. About 10 days before he reached the border, he said, he was absorbed into a group of about 40. The boy asked a reporter if he could use her phone to call his family to let them know he had arrived. He flipped the hem of his white undershirt, revealing worn digits written in permanent marker. Then he pulled the underside of the shirt further up to show where his father had written the address and phone number for his uncle in Tennessee. In a later interview, the boy's uncle, Ronaldo Valle, said the 9-year-old traveled with his father from Honduras, but they were turned back the first time they tried to enter Texas. So the father sent his son across alone. It's impossible to live in Honduras anymore, said Valle, who left his homeland a year ago. With the government corruption, the hurricanes, the gangs, what is there left to do but suffer? Imagine having so many dreams but not having any way to pursue them. They die. Vela never finds out what happens to the migrants he meets after delivering them to the busy Border Patrol agents. Do the children ever find their families? Do mothers get the chance to explain why they came? In a pocket pad, he notes just the basics. Age, country of origin, and sex. That is what he logs in his reports, year after year. A version of this story originally appeared in the Washington Post. Here's one of the obituaries for you. The Texas author who wrote Unsentimental Tales of the West, Larry McMurdy, 1936 to 2021. Larry McMurtry grew up in the desolate plains of north central Texas, and both his life and work, he never quite left them. In his long career, McMurtry wrote more than 30 novels, dozens of screenplays, and 14 nonfiction books covering many topics. But it was his unromantic tales of the American West that brought McMurtry his greatest acclaim. He came to prominence with 1961's Horseman, Passed By, and 1966's The Last Picture Show, both novels set in rural Texas and turned into lauded movies, the former as HUD, starring Paul Newman. He co-wrote the screenplay for Brokeback Mountain, about the tragic love affair between two gay cowboys, based on a short story by Annie Proulx, for which he won an Oscar in 2006. But to many critics and fans, his finest work was Lonesome Dove, a sprawling book about two retired Texas Rangers who lead a brutal 1870s cattle drive to Montana. It won a Pulitzer in 1986, became a popular miniseries, and sold well over 1 million copies. Yet to McMurtry, Lonesome Dove was in one sense a failure. All I had wanted to do was write a novel that demythologized the West, he said. Instead, it became the chief source of Western mythology. Some things you cannot explain. McMurtry was born into a family of ranchers outside Archer City, Texas, said the Associated Press. A so-so horse rider, he realized early that he lacked the manual skills needed for the ranching life. When a cousin went off to fight in World War II and left behind a box of adventure books, McMurtry found his true vocation, said the Austin American-Statesman. He attended North Texas State University, got a master's in English from Rice University, and completed Horseman Passed By, about a charismatic, amoral rancher who happily sells sick cattle to his neighbors while taking a fellowship at Stanford University. He spent years as an itinerant English teacher until freed from academia by the box office success of 1971's The Last Picture Show, said the Washington Post. The story followed restless teens in the dusty town of Thalia, a fictionalized version of Archer City, where McMurtry returned in 1988 after spending time in Houston, Los Angeles, and Virginia. At home, he'd write 5 pages every morning on his manual typewriter before breaking for biscuits and gravy at the Dairy Queen. For many years, McMurtry maintained a parallel career as an antiquarian bookseller, said the Daily Telegraph. He owned shops in Houston and Washington, D.C., before opening the massive Booked Up in Archer City, which he operated until his death. In 1991, McMurtry had a heart attack and a quadruple bypass surgery, then fell into a long depression, said the New York Times. He moved in with a woman, Diana Osana, he'd met at an all-you-can-eat catfish restaurant in Tucson. Osana became a collaborator, but not a lover. He settled into an unusual arrangement in the last years of his life, marrying the widow of former Stanford classmate Ken Kesey. She then moved in with the two of them. In later years, some critics spoke of declining quality as he recycled favored characters in numerous sequels and prequels. McMurtry had an unsentimental view of his output. "Maybe a couple of books will last," he said in 2016, "but the rest will end up on back shelves of bookshelves. There could be worse fates." Here's a couple of short coronavirus pieces on the health and science page. Passing COVID immunity from mom to baby. Pregnant women who receive a coronavirus vaccine may be able to pass along the immunity to their babies, reports the Washington Post. Several preliminary studies, which have yet to be peer-reviewed, have found COVID-19 antibodies in the umbilical cord blood of women who got the Moderna or Pfizer vaccine during pregnancy. One of the studies also detected protective antibodies in the mother's breast milk, suggesting that some level of immunity could be transferred both before and after birth. Worries about the possible risk and harm of vaccinating pregnant women may be proven quite the opposite, says Brenna Hughes, co-chair of the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists COVID Task Force. In fact, it may be proven that the vaccines actually provide protection to the developing fetus. One study examined 130 women who were vaccinated, 84 when pregnant and 31 when lactating. Antibodies were in the breast milk of nearly all the lactating women and in the umbilical cord blood of all 10 of the women who gave birth during the study. The research is important because infants are at their most vulnerable during their first months out of the womb. It's not clear how long the antibodies will last in the newborn, scientists say. And so, once COVID shots are authorized for youngsters, new parents should still plan to get their children vaccinated after they're born. Common cold versus COVID. Humanity may have an unlikely ally in the fight against COVID-19, the common cold. Some viruses compete with one another in a bid to infect a host. And the rhinovirus, the main cause of the common cold, appears to able to outcompete the coronavirus. The question of virus-virus interaction has intrigued virologists since the start of the pandemic. But because of social distancing has reduced the spread of all viruses, it hasn't been easy to study. To get around that, researchers at the University of Glasgow in the UK created a replica of the lining of the human airways using the same cells. They then introduced SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, and the rhinovirus. The rhinovirus came out on top when the two viruses were released at the same time, and even when the coronavirus was given a 24-hour head start. "This is absolutely exciting," co-author Pablo Murcia tells BBC.com, "because if you have a high prevalence of rhinovirus, it could stop new COVID infections." We're on the Talking Points page to finish out the show. First article we'll read is Biden's first presser. The reviews are in. President Biden's first press conference last week shows why he waited 65 days to have one, said Matt Lewis in the DailyBeast.com. after Biden avoided formal questions from the White House press corps for longer than any president since Calvin Coolidge, his debut presser wasn't pretty. When not reading from his notes, Biden was shaky and sometimes incoherent. Asked about Georgia's new voting restrictions, Biden ad-libbed a memorable head-scratcher. This makes Jim Crow look like Jim Eagle. But despite Biden's rambling, he did nothing that would undermine his reputation as a decent, likable, moderate, commonsensical guy. President Trump's pressers were must-see TV, said Susan Glasser in NewYorker.com. You never knew when he might suggest bleach could cure COVID or devolve into cartoonish demagoguery. Freed from this Trumpian chaos, reporters fired faux gotcha questions at Biden about immigration and the filibuster, while failing indefensibly to ask a single question about the pandemic. The White House press corps loved to grandstand when challenging Trump on the facts, said Michael Goodwin in the New York Post. But as Biden babbled untruth after untruth, a room full of 30 supposed journalists let him get away with it. When Biden claimed that the current surge of migrants at the border happens every single solitary year, no one pointed out that the numbers are the highest in 20 years. Reporters mainly wanted to know why he wasn't moving faster on his radical agenda. Often when Biden heard the topic of a question, said Scott Jennings in CNN.com, he'd start rifling through his stack of policy note cards. Attempts to speak off script devolved into a word salad. All in all, it was boring. Boring is just what this country needs after Trump, Gary Abernathy in Washington Post said. Biden stayed on message, explaining his goals for a massive infrastructure bill, detailing how U.S.-China competition is a choice between autocracy and democracy, and handling repeated questions about re-election. My plan is to run. But for many viewers, substance was secondary. They wanted to see if Biden is the doddering, senile 78-year-old that right-wing media make him out to be. Clearly, Biden is a step slower mentally than he once was, but Fox News viewers were probably surprised to witness a fully capable president answering questions for an hour. Gun control, deja vu all over again. Here we go again, said Adam Gopnik in NewYorker.com. The pandemic brought a momentary respite from mass shootings, but as the country begins to open up, here they are, right on schedule. 8 killed at Atlanta massage parlors, 10 more mowed down in a Boulder supermarket. As always, the root causes of these tragedies is not complicated. It's the astounding availability in America of weapons designed to murder human beings quickly and in large numbers. President Biden is calling for a ban on assault weapons and high-capacity magazines, and the House has passed bills to strengthen background checks and extend them to cover gun shows and private sales. Most Americans back common-sense gun regulations, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. How many more will have to die before irrational, extremist Republican politicians stop blocking them? The Democrats' proposal would achieve nothing, said National Review in an editorial. Take universal background checks. The Boulder shooter bought his gun at a store and likely passed one. As for banning so-called assault weapons, they're used so infrequently in crimes that the FBI does not even keep statistics. In a 2014 study, a pair of Stanford professors found no compelling evidence that previous assault weapon ban saved lives. The AR-15 is the most commonly owned rifle in the United States, and there is no common sense or constitutional justification for banning it. The Democrats' gun control agenda is built atop the pretense that there is an easy answer to an appalling and vexatious problem. The Constitution be damned. Democrats face a choice between lowering their aims or risking coming away with nothing, said Paul McLeod in BuzzFeedNews.com. The possible compromise is to expand background checks to gun show and online sales, but not to private transactions. Some Democrats believe they can get 60 votes with such a provision, paired with other more narrow measures, such as expanding police power to seize guns from people deemed dangerous. Even a small win could have a major significance if it marks a break in the NRA's hold on Congress. The NRA has been already weakened by its financial and legal woes, said Michael Warren in CNN.com. But many gun control advocates remain skeptical that anything will change soon. Every mass shooting, said Brian Lemick, director of Brady PAC, feels like deja vu. And just time for a couple of short notes. About 100 members of Congress, roughly a quarter, have not yet received COVID-19 vaccinations, according to House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. The shots were made available to all members of Congress more than 3 months ago. Dominion Voting Systems has filed a $1.6 billion defamation suit against Fox News for spreading false claims that the voting technology company manipulated counts in the 2020 election to benefit President Biden. The network recklessly disregarded the truth to boost its ratings, turning a small flame of disinformation into a forest fire, the suit says. Fox said it was proud of its election coverage. And we'll finish out with a quote from author Alice Munro, who says, "Why is it a surprise to find that people other than ourselves are able to tell lies?" And with that, we have run out of time for today's show. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.